Good morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in Faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Wednesday, April 16th, we are studying 2 Samuel chapter 14, verses 1 to 33. In today's text, Joab sends a woman to David in an effort to get Absalom back to Jerusalem. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor Sean Denzer. Pastor Denzer serves as the Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He is also the chaplain for the International Center in St. Louis, Missouri. Pastor Denzer, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
It's great to be back.
Pastor Denzer, we're in the dark days of David in this section. Remind us of the context leading into chapter 14.
Yeah, I really think it would be just fine for our listeners to go ahead and jump back to 2 Samuel 11, where you have David's kind of fall into sin, and then Nathan comes and preaches to him and calls him to repentance. But really to read from there on to the end of the chapter and get the rest of David's life, see all of really the prophecies that Nathan gave to David, these ramifications on account of his sin with Bathsheba, that would play out in his last days. And we are kind of in the middle of them. But I do think the context is very helpful and to see where this is going as well, because a lot of the groundwork kind of for the future spiraling of David's situation really is laid today, and it was already foretold by Nathan. It's probably going to be important for us just to know really what we heard yesterday in chapter 13, because on the basis of that, kind of everything is unfolding now. To put it simply, David has at least two sons here at this point, three. I know he's got Solomon as well. Absalom is the second oldest, and Amnon is the oldest, and apparently the heir. But he becomes infatuated with his half-sister, Tamar, and tricks her kind of into being in the same room with him, makes an advance on her, and she doesn't go for it, then forces herself upon her, and then immediately hates her. And throws her out and really, you know, not only defiles her, but also shames her on top of it. And Absalom just kind of watches this happen. This is the king's son, so it's on the king, who is his own father, to deal with it. And David kind of does nothing. And so Absalom bides his time. And when they're kind of on, looks like they're at deer camp or something, right? Oh, kind of on retreat with the sheep shearers. And then he seizes that opportunity to get revenge on his brother for defiling his sister. And they flee then because they're assuming that maybe someone will come for revenge on them. This sounds all very strange, but if you've ever studied anything about Italy, kind of, you know, late Middle Ages, early Renaissance, this is the way it goes there too. There are laws in the scriptures speaking about kind of this revenge, as well as the defense against it, that you might grab onto the horns of the altar if you were innocent to seek asylum, as it were, in the temple. So anyway, he's run away, and he then is kind of banished by David. He doesn't want him around. And that really leaves the situation we are at here, where David, through great inaction, has laid the groundwork for Absalom to commit this murder, which is a scandal already. And now, of course, that means potentially Absalom's life could be assaulted by somebody. There's a case to go in that direction and say he deserves to die as well. Or the alternative is to have mercy. And of course, the king is in the position to do that, to say, I'm going to pardon this. There was a wrong. He tried to do something about the wrong. And now we need to just put this cycle of revenge down and be done with it. David is choosing neither of those options. He's really kind of just sitting there. He is sad for his son Amnon that died, the heir. I suppose that makes sense. But he also is keeping Absalom at a distance and not acting with any kind of decisiveness. And so that sets the groundwork for this interesting kind of ruse, again, that's going to go. It really is originating from Joab, who is a trusted servant and commander of David's army. and yet one who is always kind of watching out for this inactive activity, you know, this tendency that David seems to exhibit over and over again to not act more decisively.
All right. So that's a great laying the groundwork for what we've got today. We see David's hand forced a little bit, or at least you got to think about this, David. Here's a suggestion. And we'll talk about, is this a good suggestion? And of course, hindsight's 20/20. But there's an interesting story that is told to David here in 2 Samuel chapter 14. So we turn to the text. Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. And Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, "Pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. Go to the king and speak thus to him." So Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and paid homage and said, "Save me, O king." And the king said to her, "What is your trouble?" She answered, "Alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead. And your servant had two sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to separate them, and one struck the other and killed him. And now the whole clan has risen against your servant, and they say, 'Give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed.' And so they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left, and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth." Then the king said to the woman, "Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you." And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, "On me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house. Let the king and his throne be guiltless." The king said, "If anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall never touch you again." Then she said, "Please let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more, and my son be not destroyed." He said, "As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground." Then the woman said, "Please let your servant speak a word to my lord the king." He said, "Speak." And the woman said, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself, inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again. We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. Now I have come to say this to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid. And your servant thought, 'I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant. For the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the heritage of God.' And your servant thought, 'The word of my lord the king will set me at rest. For my lord the king is like the angel of God to discern good and evil. The Lord your God be with you.'" I think I'll pause there at verse 17, the woman's story, David's verdict, and then the woman's explanation of what's going on. All of this comes from Joab, which will come back up in the king's own speech later. You mentioned Joab already. Talk to us a little bit about Joab, the fact that he's the one that brings this up. He's, I don't know, as I read Joab previously and going forward, he's certainly very loyal to David as one of David's nephews, and sometimes loyal to a fault that, I don't know, that he's always quite in the right place. What do you think of Joab's actions here?
Yeah, Joab is the man, kind of the middleman, doing David's dirty work throughout the whole Bathsheba saga. So certainly loyal, but loyal in all sorts of foolish blunders and wicked things. He's party to that. As he goes on, maybe in this section, he seems to be one who is, you know, daring. You know, he must have some kind of relationship if he's willing to take these kind of dares with his king. Notice he's still using this means to kind of make it an indirect plea, right? Instead of fighting it out or arguing, or maybe they already had the argument at the table. Obviously, David seems to be wise to it, as we'll learn in a moment. You know, so he's doing this roundabout approach, which, as with Nathan in the story about the stolen lamb, this is a form that appeals to David. I mean, he's a poet. He seems to be a very conscientious person. And so I think he thinks wisely and thinks abstractly, maybe more clearly sometimes, and that is a helpful tool then to wake him up to, have you considered the situation honestly and from a distance of what's going on? Because he so easily gets wrapped up in his emotions, it seems.
Yeah. So, okay, Joab then...
Joab, As for Job, I should say, I mean, he's just very interesting as we go forward that he later ends up, you know, he sticks with David through the rebellion of Absalom. Here he seems to be kind of supporting Absalom, but we'll see him at the end of this also supporting David in his kind of inaction, even after this first part of the action has been taken, right? That no longer is Absalom banished, but Joab will also kind of give the cold shoulder on behalf of David toward Absalom. So, and in the end, he does actually side with someone else's rebellion, you know, against Solomon, which is very interesting.
Yeah, Joab, if he is supportive of Absalom at the outset of this chapter, by the end of the chapter, he'll have a very good reason not to be quite as supportive of Absalom, as we will see the conflict escalates there. Thinking about, so Joab, he knows what David is thinking concerning Absalom. We talked about it at the end of chapter 13, that David, it says, mourned for his son day after day, and that's probably both sons that he's mourning for, not only Amnon who has died, but Absalom now who is banished. Joab knows this, and so he attempts to do something about it by going and getting a wise woman from Tekoa. That's the same place that the prophet Amos is from. And he gives her the ruse, go and pretend to be a mourner, and he gives her the story to tell. And then we hear the story put in front of David. If you have any other details about the woman herself, bring those out. But then take us into the story that she is given to tell and that she does tell to David.
I don't know how significant it is, just that someone who's going to be able to carry this out well. I don't know if she's an actor. I don't know if that's part of the wisdom. Tekoa is just south of Bethlehem, so I don't know if this is kind of a hometown pull at David's heartstrings as well. But I mean, I think it's laid out easily. Maybe the challenging thing to grasp is what is the analogy of this story. So her story is, my one son killed the other son, and now, you know, revenge demands that the first son be killed, but the murderer be killed. But what do I do? That would leave with no heirs. It would destroy everything. The analogy is that David has the same situation, of course. The heir has been killed. The next heir also, now it seems, ought to have judgment or destruction based on him, or at least certainly to leave it in limbo always leaves the possibility that A, he will be murdered and then there'll be no heir, or B, he will just kind of live this questionable existence, and when the time comes for him to inherit the throne, will his legitimacy as a king be questionable? And the, you know, just as the woman is going to lose her household if she has no heir, it's the stakes are much higher. This is the king of Israel. If you can think all the way back to the days of Samuel, we know what he said about Israel having a king in the first place, that it would not be good for them, that it would actually have its own problems too. There's a way in which it seems the judges is the most precarious situation, and yet it's the one that is precarious from a human perspective so that it can be fully reliant on the Lord as the true king of Israel. They have given that up for the, quote, stability, absolutely in air quotes, of a king. And now they're discovering that, of course, you have the same sorts of instabilities, just in different ways, with a king. And so, in a sense, this woman, or you can see Joab as a wise counselor and as a at least thoughtful and shrewd man, even if he is wrong in any particulars, he knows you can't have a king be destroyed, or you risk losing the whole nation. You risk the whole kingdom falling into disorder. If there's not a clear line of succession, you know, if there's no planning for the future, in other words, you're going to be caught by every little surprise that comes, and it's easy for political wrangling. I mean, there's plenty of political wrangling that's happening even as we go forward, but it would be even worse if you have kind of this pall of illegitimacy hanging over Absalom, and then at some point, he's supposed to arise to the throne. It really is a call for David to sharpen what is the case with Absalom. Is he a murderer that deserves to die? Let's get on with that judgment. Is he restored because you're the king and you're pardoning him? Let's make that proclamation. Let's have that public reconciliation. But the worst possible is just to leave it in this gray area. And so that's the idea, and that's the concern that the woman brings through this story.
Yeah, and that, I mean, with Joab in the background, think about his role in the first part of 2 Samuel with the civil war between the house of David and the house of Saul. Joab saw some of those things play out right in front of his eyes. And so, again, it's, who knows exactly what Joab is thinking in the background. He's certainly sympathetic toward David. Is he sympathetic toward Absalom? Or maybe does he even realize kind of what is to come with Absalom, that if David doesn't bring him back or do something with him in any way, shape, or form, Absalom will become a thorn in David's side in one way or another. So there is great human wisdom, and at least urging David, you've got to do something about this. And so the story that the woman tells is applicable to the king and his situation with Absalom. Are you going to do justice for the murderer and put him to death for his crime, or are you going to forgive him and bring him back? Which will it be, David? I think the woman pushes toward bringing the banished one back, as her application suggests. Before we get to the application, though, this little back and forth that you have between the king and the woman in verses 8 to 11, it's like she's kind of forcing his hand more and more. How do you take that back and forth between the king and the woman in verses 8 to 11?
I enjoy, first of all, hearing kind of these pleasantries. You can hear this, you read things from Assyria and from Persia, and they have their own ways of speaking. Persia tries to make it seem very mystical and wise. Assyria is always talking about, and then I slew this guy, blah, 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 you know, real rough and tough kind of guys. Or think about Nebuchadnezzar, right, with Daniel and with the three men, and how they're always speaking, true, O king, you know, O king, live forever. You got to say that address when you go up to him. You hear all of the pleasantries and the traditional ceremonies that you have, I guess, for the king of David. And I do love the way, you know, the faith, we can say, is wrapped into this thing, right? As the Lord lives, I want you to swear by God. You know, the Lord has his ways of doing things. So are you going to pursue them, David? You know, so It is, and beseeching David on behalf of the people of God in particular, right? What is at stake here? The woman says, why have you planned such a thing against the people of God? She does understand that the purpose of a king, as it's been set up in Israel, is to care for the people of God and to shepherd the flock of Israel in the stead, by the command, you might say, of the Lord, and after the manner that the Lord would want them to be shepherded, to be a tool and an instrument of the Lord's work. And so, you know, it's just really wonderful, I think, to see the way that people would be accustomed to speak. You can see there's a bit of fear behind it, right? This is, you know, I'm going to be humble. I'm going to come in submission and not presume upon anything, but beseech the king and implore the king. I think you do find this. Sometimes we think that's maybe just an Anglican tradition that's been brought into Lutheranism through things like the King James Bible and influence from, you know, America. But here we see some reflections of that and probably where that developed as well, even in those countries, is, you know, you see the respect that is given to the king. And so there's always the potential that the king shows you disfavor and that this actually ends up worse for you. Not that David has shown himself to be that impulsive or impetuous, but she's coming with that kind of niceties and ceremonial, but pushing it, right? So I think you have kind of two images here. You have Abraham. Think about how he sought the Lord out to save the city where Lot was living. And he, you know, works the Lord down. If there's 100 people, great. If there's 10 people, well, what if there's only 5 people? What if it's just Lot, my brother? And this kind of slow progression that pushes a little more. We might find that pushy and annoying, but the Lord, in fact, is often glad to be pushed, it seems. Also, remember the tale that Jesus tells about the persistent widow, right? That even one who is frustrated or very busy, finally, for the sake of one who is persistent, may actually come through. David shows himself to be receptive to all of this, ready to let her speak, willing to almost be bound, right? These are almost legal statements that are made. Like, let me hear that the Lord actually, you're going to invoke the Lord your God on this adventure. That's like putting the, you might say, the wax seal of the king on this, except this is, you know, as the Lord lives, I'm going to make this decree. So it has the force of God's judgment if anyone defies it. So she is, in fact, engaging him in this kind of legal battle to make a firm conviction, a firm statement, almost you could say a decree of the king, a judgment and a law, and then on the basis of that to kind of spring the trap of the matter and say, aren't you doing the exact same thing to our people?
Yeah, the invoking of the people of God there in verse 13, I do think is significant. Why have you planned this against the people of God? Going all the way back into 2 Samuel 11 when this whole mess got started, I think you do see David neglecting the people of God for his own selfish interests in chapter 11. And then so far in the aftermath of chapter 13 and 14, David doesn't seem to be thinking about the ramifications for the people of God. He's focused in only on himself, his own family, his sons, without realizing the role of shepherding that he's been given to this entire people, and in that way is being negligent toward his duty as a shepherd of God's people. That's what the role of the king is to be, and he's not doing that. I mean, any more thoughts on the negligence of David, the importance of keeping in view the entire job of being the shepherd for God's people?
I mean, he's an older man. He doesn't show himself to be particularly, you know, slow to act or delaying. Earlier in life, obviously, he jumps up and says, if nobody else is going to fight Goliath, I guess it'll have to be me. You know, and certainly he's a man of war. He's a man of action. But we see this changing. I don't know if we'd like to credit this to his fall into sin with Bathsheba. I mean, I really do think it is his inaction of not going to war that gives him the time for idle hands to pursue false things. So already we're seeing that tendency at play. I don't know how you'd like to.
I think that's all helpful. It's a theme that I don't know that I've noticed quite as much in this until reading that line about this thing against the people of God, that David just kind of needs to wake up and do his job a little bit. And that's maybe a more crass way of saying it than she puts it, but he's not been focused on. It's his idleness led him into the sin in the first place, and now his inactivity, his indecisiveness has led him to this spot. And it's to the detriment of God's people is what she and both Joab are getting at. And I think that's a significant point. I don't have anything else really to say. Just I appreciate her bringing that out. Now,
that famous phrase about David's the man after God's own heart.
Sure.
I always am just in the back of my mind kind of applying that to every situation of David and asking, okay, what is the aspect of that ought to be in the forefront? And, you know, is there something in this inaction that we can see reflective of God or positive? The only thing that comes to mind is what Peter talks about in his epistle, that the Lord is slow, not as some count slowness, although they do count him to be slow, that he delays for the sake of repentance. And, you know, David's actions seem to be very conscientious. He's concerned for these people, right? We've already prefaced this entirely with his heart goes out to Absalom. He actually really wants to be reconciled to him, but he is slow to do it. Now, ultimately, I don't think the impression is favorable on David's delay and dithering, but this is probably what happens when you've done something wicked and when you have a pronunciation given from the prophet that says, the sword's not going to depart from your house, people are going to rise up against you. And now it causes David to play everything slow, right? Everything careful, not take any more risks. And as well as, now his risks are personal, right? They're legacy connected. Whereas, as Joab and this woman point out, his concern for risk-taking or for care and safety has to be, what is best for my people, right? That is actually the charge that he's given as a king. Just one more thing that is not in the background of our story, but should be. Don't forget that the book of Chronicles patterns and mirrors the book of Kings. In Chronicles, we hear so much more about the activity surrounding the temple, right? Not the literal house of who's going to inherit from me and who's going to go on, etc., but the promise that I'm going to establish your house and his son is going to complete the temple. So that could be offered, I think, as a, what, you know, what is David putting his mind to since he's not thinking very clearly about Absalom? It could be that he is almost understanding that the Lord has promised that his sons will reign, that his line will continue, and he shifted his focus kind of to this legacy work of let's build the temple, let's draw up the designs, let's order up the divisions of priests, you know, and then Solomon then will take over the plans and get it done.
Yeah, and so David's inactivity is brought to his attention. this woman brings it up, and she's got more to say to David. I do want to talk a little bit more about some of the things she says before she, you know, just says, you need to bring the banished one back. But I want to talk about some of the details she has. We'll do that on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We are talking to Pastor Sean Denzer this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Who does Lutheran Church Extension Fund serve, you ask? It's simple. We serve Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries and church workers with loans and ministry services. And it's faithful Lutherans like you, church members and church workers alike, investing with LCEF that makes it possible for LCEF to serve these ministries. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Wednesday, April 16th. We're studying 2 Samuel chapter 14, verses 1 to 33 with Pastor Sean Denzer. He is Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He's also the chaplain for the International Center in St. Louis, Missouri. Pastor Denzer, prior to the break, we were talking about the application of the story that the woman gives to David. She notes how David is not thinking about the people of God in his inaction toward Absalom. And then in verse 14, she, as you said during the break to me, she lays it on thick. She says, "We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, and he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast." What do you make of her words there? Is she laying it on thick? Is there theology to be taken from that? Is that more like the friends of Job who aren't always right? What do you take on from verse 14?
I mean, I think she's hired to be an actress. Why shouldn't she? She should go for it. So, you know, who can turn away your Jewish mother who's, you know, coming with a question? And that's kind of the story we have here. A widow, in fact, as well. She's talking about the people of God being spilled on the ground. I would understand this to be scattered, right? Chaotic. This is what is going to happen when we have the split in the family as well. Splits in the family come from ambiguity. You know, I think you're also trying to ask the question of whether she's right to want the banished one to be brought back. But essentially what she's foretelling, whether of course she knows the future or not, is, look, if we don't have a firm king, and if we don't have a firm line of succession, which is what you need for kings, that our whole nation is just kind of precariously perched. I think this fits. I think this fits for kind of, A, the faithlessness of Israel, that's why they wanted a king in the first place, is they did not trust that the Lord, through his judges and through his temple, was actually going to preserve them despite their precarious position. David should know, of course, that, you know, he spreads the banquet in the presence of his enemies, as his own psalm says. But that's the analogy that's here, that will be scattered forever. And then in her invoking God and saying God won't take away life, he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. I do think this is theological in that, A, the Lord wants things to be done. B, it doesn't have to be that we just let revenge take its course over and over again, eye for an eye forever. But also, this should call to mind confidence in what the Lord has said, right? Consider Abraham's response to the command from God to slay Isaac. I think the more natural thing for us to do is to say, God either wants me to kill him, so I'm going to kill him, and that's the end of it, or this is wrong, this is a test, so I'm not going to do what God says. I'm going to defy him because we need to keep him alive. Abraham is the one who says the Lord is actually going to make use of this. He's going to raise him from the dead, and he's going to work through this. So we have the promise to David that his house is going to continue, that so long as he keeps God's commands, that actually his sons will continue on the throne, and he'll have a literal heir as well. this is the path that's being put forward, as this can be a godly way to have that heir on the throne as well. And so I think as far as anyone can see at this point, I don't see anything wrong in what she's saying. I think she is pushing pretty hard, of course, but she's trying to overcome this cycle of inaction, right? Very interesting in the phrase before, right? The king is given a decision, right? In a story, in a hypothetical, let's give it, or in a small matter with some individual woman that he can care for and see empathy for, he needs to make the same kind of decision for the good of the whole people, for the kingdom.
All right. So she lays this in front of the king with all of these appeals. Anything more through what we've read in verse 17? She says, "The Lord your God be with you" at the end. That's nice to see once again the faith of this woman on her lips. Any other details from her application to the story before we read about David's response and how we do hear he knows about Joab in the background?
Maybe two more things. So in verse 16, I think it's interesting that she doesn't kind of break character after she's, you know, come out and said, "Aren't you actually doing the same thing with our people?" She still has a son, right, that she's worried about, right? "Me and my son together from the heritage of God." So who knows? Maybe this isn't actually a story. Maybe they found a woman and they just try to encourage her to ham it up a little bit. But the other thing I find very interesting is that the word of the Lord, the king, will set me at rest. Okay, she is willing to receive his judgment. She's a good citizen through all this, even if there's been a little bit of, you know, winking and nodding going on. But the other thing is this marvelous statement, which gets repeated by others as well, that the king is like the angel of God to discern good and evil. Angel of God, of course, is often used to mean Christ himself. So she could be like the Lord in that regard. That he has a form of wisdom that is recognized to be divine. I think this ought to be taken according to his office, that his wisdom is going to be respected because his wisdom comes from God. Here, I think we certainly can see a man after the Lord's own heart and operating with the Lord's wisdom.
All right, let's go ahead and read the more of this text as David responds to the way that this woman appeals to him. This is verse 18. "Then the king answered the woman, 'Do not hide from me anything I ask you.' And the woman said, 'Let my lord the king speak.' The king said, 'Is the hand of Joab with you in all this?' The woman answered and said, 'As surely as you live, my lord the king, one cannot turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my lord the king has said. It was your servant, Joab, who commanded me. It was he who put all these words in the mouth of your servant. In order to change the course of things, your servant Joab did this. But my lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God to know all things that are on the earth.' Then the king said to Joab, 'Behold, now I grant this. Go bring back the young man Absalom.' And Joab fell on his face to the ground and paid homage and blessed the king. And Joab said, 'Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, in that the king has granted the request of his servant.' So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, 'Let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence.' So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence." All right, we'll pause there again at verse 24. So verses 18 to 20 sound a little bit more like some of the pleasantries, David discerning what's really going on here, making sure he understands the situation before he gives an answer. Just go into that back and forth between verses 18 to 20.
Yeah, he's been caught, so I think he heard the connection that she made earlier. He didn't forbid her to speak anymore. His response is not anger, right? This is part of the wisdom of David, is when he finds, when it meets correction, he receives it. And certainly Solomon in the Proverbs speaks over and over about how this is the central characteristic of wisdom, that it's willing to receive correction and welcome those who counsel in a way that's, you know, opposing what you've been doing, or in this case, what he hasn't been doing. Yeah, he recognizes this sounds like Joab. Joab must have put you up to this, in other words. And this idiom, to not turn from the right or to the left, I think is helpful to see kind of, this is a description of what she has been doing, right? Mm-hmm. How about this? Well, isn't that an awful lot like that? And and now we're going to say it straight. Yeah, that's right. I can't pull the wool over your eyes. Of course it was Joab. He gave me these words. Why? And she comes out and says it directly, in order to change the course of things. That's why he did this. It's not to fight you. It's not to be against you. It's not to undermine you. But it's, in fact, to try and reason and bring you to your senses and argue as a wise person. This is a good thing. People have arguments. People discuss and reason through things. A voters meeting, if nothing else. But we do this every day at work, too. It's necessary, and it's useful. And to be able to have an argument that deals substantively with the issues and doesn't cause us to dig in our heels and want to do what we want to do at all costs, I mean, is a wise thing. So if you're looking for ways to redeem David, it's certainly that he gives some heed to this and recognizes that these great lengths that the woman and Joab have gone to accomplish this are really so that it can go through, because it's worth it to them and because it's an important thing. She now still says, hey, the Lord, you, my Lord, that is David, has wisdom of the angel of God to know these things, can figure me out, obviously. So what is the right thing to do? And the answer, as we see, is yes, we're going to do this. We're going to bring him back. We're going to have him come.
Kind of. So that word is given to Joab in verse 21, who either has been kind of in the court all along, or perhaps he goes and David summons Joab to give him the answer that does go to Joab rather than this to this woman. And you have a back and forth between David and Joab again, these official court pleasantries that are happening as David gives the decision, bring Absalom back. And yet, where we stopped reading, there still remains a little bit of indecisiveness and inactivity on David's part, or incompleteness on David's part, because the king doesn't actually bring him back all the way. He still dwells away from Jerusalem. So take us into this decision that David gives.
Yeah, Geshur's way up north, Bashan, you know, off to kind of the east and north of Jerusalem. So it's a long way away. He gets to come back to Jerusalem, but he isn't living in his house. And I think probably the best way to understand this is in the court, right? So he's not part of the business affairs. He's not doing the sort of thing that you expect a son, the son who is going to be the heir. He's not doing any of those things that you would expect in being part of the court. If you're not part of the court, you're neither learning from experience and exposure. You're neither hobnobbing and networking. And you're not having this daily interaction with David. In fact, I mean, so strong that he doesn't really want him to see him or be in his presence. This is really at odds with the way it described David, you know, having his heart go out to him, having his spirit go out to him, you know, really wanting Absalom around. All this bitterness is just kind of festering and not being dealt with or reconciled. This also is something that's spoken of in the scriptures. That level of inaction does not solve the problem. It just lets it fester. It's the sort of thing that could breed long-term resentment. And I think it's kind of no surprise that that is on the horizon, even though that's not going to be our chapter today.
All right, so let's go ahead and keep reading, because David now has brought Absalom back, although he's not in the king's presence, and that creates more tension that David does or doesn't deal with without some help. So we're picking up the text again in 2 Samuel 14, verse 25. Now in all Israel there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was heavy on him, he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head 200 shekels by the king's weight. There were born to Absalom 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. So Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. Then Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but Joab would not come to him. And he sent a second time, but Joab would not come. Then he said to his servants, "See, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." So Absalom's servants said, "Set the field on fire." Then Joab arose and went to Absalom at his house and said to him, "Why have you, your servants, set my field on fire?" Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent word to you, come here, that I may send you to the king to ask, 'Why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now, therefore, let me go into the presence of the king, and if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death.'" Then Joab went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. And that takes us to the end of our text for today, to the end of 2 Samuel chapter 14. There's a brief interlude, verses 25 to 27, to tell us especially about the appearance of Absalom and a little bit about his family. Talk about some of those details.
It's foreshadowing. We're setting up for future things. This apparently seemed like the moment. But it probably reflects, you know, while he's been kind of in exile, he has prospered. He's grown up as a man. He's shown himself all the more suitable to be an heir. So, again, it's not surprising that the woman would come and say, hey, resolve this because we want the line to continue. We want the surety and the stability of Israel to rest and to continue. And having a king matters for that. Yeah, he's handsome. I believe David was described this way as well. So he's a chip off the old block, but maybe even to more extremes. And then this note about the hair, which 200 shekels, I think, is about like 5 pounds, right? I've never measured my hair or anyone's hair before. That's just not how I think. But big, thick, I assume it must be curly. I mean, we're obviously setting up, people probably know that he gets right. His hair caught in the tree, and so he's got to have enough hair to be caught, and he lets it grow. That's how I like to do it, too, as few haircuts as possible.
Except when it gets too heavy.
Right. I don't have that problem, at least. So
you wouldn't want to shave that beard, Pastor Denzer.
Thank you. Now, there is an inconsistency, or maybe there's more to the story. Here it says that Absalom has 3 sons. Later, it says that he had this, it gives a note about his tower that he had built or some kind of a statue that was a monument to the fact that he had no heir, that Absalom had no son to be an heir. So it kind of suggests that maybe these children died or something's a little strange there. Probably the other thing that is strange and confusing for us is now we have another person named Tamar, and this is Absalom's daughter, so not his sister. That was the one who was defiled, but now his daughter. It seems to me that he must have named her after his sister, right? I don't know if it was to cheer her up or... It shows, again, his affection for his sister, which a godly affection, as opposed to his brother who had had that wicked affection.
So thinking about Absalom's appearance and the way that it does certainly set up things that are to come, these are important details. The book has been doing that all along, giving us details ahead of time that become important later. I do wonder, with the emphasis on his appearance, especially that, you know, no one is more handsome than Absalom is, and the way that we've been told physical characteristics of both kings previous, Saul and David, and yet those physical characteristics are not the most important thing. Here we have another physical description of a man who's a wonderfully looking man. He's got this fantastic hair, and yet he's not going to be the king that we need. Ultimately, the king that we need, Isaiah is going to tell us, has nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. You think there's maybe something going on there with that description of Absalom physically?
Yes, and it's hard for me not to take a very practical approach to this, that we know the better-looking candidate seems to win sometimes, and that so much of everything that surrounds earthly politics can be cosmetic.
Sure, and, especially in the age of television and screens.
Right, but... but you get the impression this is brought out there also because through flattery and through kind of outward interactions, this is how Absalom is going to win over the hearts of the people in the long run. And for that to be his downfall, I think is also a pretty, yeah, absolutely. And as you bring up, the true king is quite different, that Christ our Lord is described as not dramatically beautiful or whatever, and by Isaiah's word that he was not even recognized for that. It's the vision of the transfiguration is maybe the exception. And there the Lord says, we're not going to talk about this until after the real work, which will be even uglier, my death, has been accomplished for the sins of the world.
All right, so Absalom has been described as a handsome man. This becomes an important detail in the narrative going forward. And then our chapter finishes with an interaction between Absalom and Joab. This happens 2 years after Absalom has been brought back but hasn't gone into the king's presence. And we get a sense as to whether or not Absalom, well, what kind of king he might make beyond his appearance. How would he rule? This is quite the story. Talk about the interaction between Absalom and Joab here.
Yeah, I mean, I sympathize with Absalom, at least so far. He's getting the cold shoulder, which is just not the way, I don't know, it's not the way I would expect a man's man like David to deal with a problem. He's not dealing with it at all. And now Joab, his commander, I mean, this is playing games. This is, I'm sending letters. Oh, I must have deleted that email. You know, no, you didn't. You just didn't open it. You just didn't answer it. You opened it. It says you opened it on this day, right? And it causes Absalom kind of to lash out, to be maybe a little impetuous. You could chalk this up to youth, or you could chalk it up to his deep disposition as well. But certainly rebelling against his father also in that respect, that he's going to do something to get it going. And so that's his idea is, fine, start a fire in his field. That'll wake him up, and then he'll at least have to come and deal with, hey, why'd you do that? Oh, so you do list answer your mail. You do pay attention, look out your window every once in a while. Let's do something about it. And here, I think, based on what we've seen, I don't know if this is the right approach to accomplish it, but Absalom is not wrong that something ought to be done, that if I'm worthy of death, you know, let the king pronounce his sentence. If not, don't do this half measure.
Hmm. Yeah, so let's talk more, and this is maybe thinking forward into the narrative. You talk about how his appearance described here sets things up later. Is the way that he acts here, although I think he's right, you know, let's not do this halfway. If you're going to bring me back or don't at all. But is there perhaps on Absalom's part here some setting up for things that he already is planning, even if it's not made explicit in the narrative at this point?
Well, he does need to come back if he's going to try and make a run at being king himself. And that's, of course, what he's going to do in the coming chapter. He's really going to take over. He's going to take advantage of his father's inaction to show himself to be a man of action and a man of decisiveness. And sometimes that's needed. If you're worried about somebody building legacy and failing to look at address the real problems that he has, or failing to plan for the future in a way that's productive for his people, you do make yourself ripe for an election, or for, you know, or in these times, for somebody to wage a coup. And so, I mean, Absalom has a little bit of shrewdness in that regard. I think that he is taking advantage of a weak time for David. Now, that doesn't mean that he ought to be taking advantage of that and you know, plotting a coup, but you know, I think all of this is just, he's going to show himself the one that's at least moving things forward. Hey, I don't know if it's going to be for the better or not, but I'm going to be the kind of guy who moves it forward, and Absalom's doing that.
Yeah, it is. If you think back to the story that the woman told to David, how she certainly was pushing for bringing the banished one home, bring him back. Absalom, I think, echoes that decision that David needs to make, although he maybe pushes the bounds a little bit more. He says, like, do one or the other. He doesn't say necessarily, like, only this is your only option. You could just put me to death. And I think in that sense, he forces Joab's hand, he forces David's hand to do something here. And David does. Talk to us about the action that is taken at the end of the text.
I think it's a challenge. You know, fine, you're going to kill me? You're going to fire me? Go for it. Otherwise, and, you know, when you say it that way, you're not really expecting them actually to go forward with killing him. And if David's been so inactive so far, why in the world would he pick up his sword and sure. show? It's that kind of impetuousness. So,
yeah.
All right. So Joab listens. He does it. Joab has been the guy who sees reason, at least in these couple chapters, and so he does that too. And when he brings him in, it goes very well, right? He bows himself to the ground before the king, shows himself in submission. Here's my head, I suppose, if you're going to do that. And David does what it seems like, to be perfectly honest, David did have in his heart the whole time to reconcile with him, to have a show of affection and kissing. I don't think this is fake in any way. As we'll see, even when things go very bad, David shows great affection, does not want Absalom to be killed or to die, and he mourns for him. You know, so now that it's forced and it's put into David's lap, he does the right thing in the moment, but he needed to, you know, act decisively earlier. It's especially important in relationships when someone's been wronged that we deal with it. If we don't, it often festers into problems, so that even if forgiveness and reconciliation comes, these, you know, doubts linger. This this wrong that is hard to quantify, the wrong of receiving the cold shoulder and the silent treatment for a while, that is very hard because it's so nebulous. It's a non-action. It's also very hard to address and forgive and get over. And hardly can imagine that that's not behind some of the actions that Absalom takes, some of the animosity and kind of shocking betrayal that we're able to see from him. You know, so deal with it, right? That is certainly the way the scriptures talk about it too. We want to go and meet our accusers. We want to reconcile while we're on the way. We want to be quick to deal with this and for us as Christians to see it led into forgiveness.
We've got about 2 minutes left on the morning, Pastor Denzer, wrapping up 2 Samuel chapter 14. I think those you've already given us some applications. Any more application for our lives as Christians, and how does a chapter like this point us toward Christ?
I would say on the story, I think you're pushing a little bit toward conspiracy, or as if Absalom had this in plan all along. It's possible. But I think it's also possible that, you know, in solving one problem, you don't account for all of the trade-offs and all of the possibilities that follow. And so much of this chapter is tied up in earthly security that, based in the king and his line. This is the concern that Joab brings. This is the concern that the woman knows how to voice in terms of concern for her household. David must have some kind of concern that he's afraid of goofing up the whole situation or something, so he's just going to let it simmer and wait. Those concerns show us just how often we get wrapped up in our minds and in our emotions about things in this world rather than dealing with them as they come to us. Rather than putting our trust in God, our anxieties are best cast into our prayers and given to the Lord who actually cares for us in all things, and then to our neighbors, you know, to speak open words to them, honest words to them, truthful words to them, to seek reconciliation, to act early, to admit when we're wrong. All of these wisdom, we would recognize these as wise and good communication skills. They're just so much better, and the way it ought to be with one another. And our anxieties are much better given to God, who says he will care for them and listen to them. In all of this, we should be concerned, I suppose, about the heir, because Christ is going to be the heir. It's of the fruit of the body that will be set on the throne forever. There is another son in the background. It's Solomon. He's not mentioned at all. And the reason is he's very young, right? He doesn't seem like a very wise king or a suitable guy to anoint because it's just he's way too young and it's too early. Of course, that is also how David was found, according to the Lord's will. So maybe that's a foolish thing. It is fitting, I think, ultimately to see that Solomon, who becomes this great, wisest man ever to live, is in the background and kind of overlooked and unimportant for so much of all of this catastrophe. The Lord will bring his salvation and his wisdom in his time, and that's kind of being shown to all of us here by the very one that nobody's talking about actually is going to be a perfect solution and much more stable even than David has been, obviously.
Pastor Sean Denzer serves as the Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He's also the chaplain of the International Center in St. Louis, Missouri. He's been helping us today to study 2 Samuel 14, verses 1 to 33. Pastor Denzer, thanks for being our guest today.
You're welcome.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about 2 Samuel 14, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It's always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we keep reading in 2 Samuel. We're in chapter 15 and we see whatever Absalom had been thinking in the past, now he comes to conspiracy against his father David in an effort to take the throne away. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to KFUO.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to KFUO.org/store.